Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The first half of this year, Robert Toller and Karen Toller lived in Hanoi, Vietnam. They were there to observe both the agricultural scene and life in general. Dr. Toller is professor and head of animal range sciences at SDSU, and he joins us today from the Janine Basinger studio at South Dakota State University. Welcome back.
Thank you, Lori. It's great to be back.
And the last time you were here, we talked about the Fulbright Scholar Program and the fact that you were headed to the Vietnam National University of Agriculture of Hanoi, and now you have been and have returned. So for those who didn't hear that first conversation, talk a little bit about the Fulbright Program and what your intention was for going to Vietnam as a swine specialist.
Sure. In the 1950s, Senator Fulbright out of Arkansas set up a program to have intellectual exchanges with faculty members from U.S. universities to go over to other countries and help improve food production because, again, from his standpoint, and I think that's been well documented, one of the easiest, quickest causes of wars is when people don't have enough food. And so his goal was to help get other countries' food production up enough so there could be peaceful times.
All right, so you signed on to this program, it seems obvious, but what made you personally say yes to it? What were you hoping to achieve?
Yep, a lot of different things really came into place. You know, I was born in 1960, so while I didn't serve in the Vietnam War, it was a part of everyday life growing up. Also then, I spent a lot of time in China, did a little bit of consulting in Vietnam with the U.S. Grains Council and U.S. Soybean Export Council, and kind of fell in love with the country. And they're rapidly growing economically, and so there's a lot of reasons to go there. But what my plan was, just like you've seen in other countries, they're modernizing their agriculture. And especially on the swine side, they're going from very small backyard production to some larger scale operations to help improve efficiency. But then the problem then comes in, how are you going to handle the manure? And so that was my goal, is to go over there and help them improve their swine production and also look at helping them to utilize livestock manure as a valuable nutrient for crops that they're growing.
And I think, I didn't get to listen to our whole conversation from last time, but I thought I remembered you saying you were going to connect with your wife back in South Dakota and the school children that she had. Now I see that she went with you. How did that transpire?
It worked out really well. So my wife, Karen, is a 7th grade English teacher at Mickelson Middle School, and the Brookings School Board was gracious enough to give her a sabbatical. And so what Karen was doing is on a weekly basis, she would send back a written blog, but also she would do weekly or more frequently a YouTube video. Anytime we were out on the street seeing something or doing a tour somewhere, she'd get out her phone and do a two-minute YouTube video, load it up, and the kids got to see it back in Brookings as well as a lot of other people in South Dakota.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the livestock work and the swine production work that you did. Was it, it can be difficult to take something that works well in South Dakota and sort of figure out how does it fit in this different model. Talk a little bit about their production and what they're trying to do specifically, if you would.
Yep, it really does. And that's one of the things, that's one of the blessings of being older. Yeah, you make a lot of mistakes. And so now when I travel internationally, the first thing I tell people is there's no one right way to raise pigs. I mean, everybody does it a different way, and you have good reasons for doing that. So when I would talk at the university and work with producers and those kinds of groups, I said basically, look, here's how we do things in the United States, and here's why we do it. And a prime example would be you look at feed costs. Okay, we have some of the cheapest feed costs in the world. The corn and soybean and DDGS prices in Vietnam are twice as expensive as what we have. So they may make a certain a business decision totally different what we would do, Lori, because their feed costs are so much more. And so that's one of the things that we did. And it was really interesting because, again, they are going through that transition from many, many, many small farms to some larger farms. And it's much like what we saw in the 1980s and 1990s in the United States. So there's a lot of social issues that come up that way. I mean, people are going out of business. It affects families, it affects communities, affects people at the university. You know, that was one of the questions they had. And so, you know, what can we do to help our people? And so it was kind of funny. I went back to, I've been here at SDSU for 30 years now, so I went back to some of the extension programs that we would do. in the late 80s, early 90s. Simple things like record keeping, you know, your production costs, those kinds of things, and something they hadn't done yet there. So some of the stuff that we've lived through, I was able to share and hopefully make a difference with them.
Are there ways to avoid some of the downsides of that as far as, you know, the smaller farmers and the family impact of people going out of business? Is there a way through hindsight to say, here's how we can improve food production without, you know, getting rid of the small producer?
It really makes it difficult because the way they're, especially on the feed system is set up, they're importing almost all their grain stuffs, and you have to work through brokers, you have to work through feed companies. And just like everything else, agriculture is a global business, you know, and so, you know, they actually import some pork products from the U.S. And so the challenge becomes as people, as whatever industry you pick becomes more and more efficient, that might mean maybe even less profit per unit sold. So again, there's nothing to say that a small producer can't be efficient, can't be profitable, but if you look at generating family living expenses, that's what becomes an issue. And in Vietnam, actually what they would like to do, because the big problem I think they have, Lori, is the average farm size is 2 acres. So one family has to support their children and everybody on 2 acres. And so that might be a half acre cornfield, a quarter acre rice field, another quarter acre for some vegetables. And so, you know, and so it's subsistence living. And so kind of like what you see in China, you know, as they increased their industrial base, created more factories, people were able to move off the farm. And instead of a 2 acre farm, you might have a 10 acre farm or it gets bigger. So, and in a lot of ways, I mean, there's a ton of ways that Vietnam and China are different, but economically they're kind of same. So Vietnam is probably where China was about 15 years ago. Hmm. Their economy is starting to roll. They're building up their infrastructure. And so we can see that happening, but again, they do a lot of other things differently.
Has the international trade battle and tariffs impacted the economic relationship on an ag perspective between the United States and Vietnam?
No, not at all. Actually, it's probably helped. And the thing that surprised me the most is that the Vietnamese love Americans. I mean, I'm not just saying they literally love Americans. We were treated graciously and warmly everywhere we were. And you know, again, we lived in Hanoi. We traveled a lot, but we were in Hanoi. And like the gentleman I worked with, Professor Tan, he was the dean of the College of Animal Science, you know, over 2,000 students. And when I first met him, he said, well, you know, tell me about yourself. So I told him about caring for the kids and my family. And so I said, well, tell me about yourself. And he said, well, you know, I've got a sister and a mother. In those days, though, he said, we had bigger families. He goes, my dad was killed in the war with the Americans, and he just keeps on going like nothing had happened. And I think that's the big thing in Vietnam. You know, they won the war, they moved on, and they want a better life for themselves and their family, and they see the U.S. as the best way helping them to do that. So there is nothing but open arms for Americans in Vietnam.
And did you see that other Americans in Vietnam as tourists or as, you know, other business connections? Did you see other Americans there?
A great deal. And I think that's really interesting. And actually, Karen probably fulfilled half the Fulbright with English education. There's a huge desire and demand for everybody in Vietnam to learn English. It's an international language of business, of science. And so even at schools, they start at a really young age. We've had a lot of friends in the apartment that we lived at. Hey, you know, Karen, would you be willing to teach us English? Because they want to get stronger and that ability, English speaking ability. So, and we would see in our apartment complex, it was a young gentleman, you know, he had like a history degree from somewhere in Wisconsin, but he was a full-time English teacher in Vietnam. So they're scrambling to get as many people as they can to help him teach English because that's the direction the country wants to move.
Tell us a little bit about what your and Karen's living was like then. You mentioned the apartment, and tell us, you know, what were you eating and where were you going and what were some of the cultural surprises that you happened upon?
You know, the first month we lived in downtown Hanoi, and it was great. It was a pretty, a little bit of a shady apartment, kind of a shady neighborhood, but it was a blast. The people were great. And we loved it. We explored a lot. The only problem that we had, it was an hour and 10 minutes from work. The university was on the other side of the river, so we would walk for a half hour, get a bus ride another 40 minutes, and that got to be long. So we Even though we hated to leave it, we found another place that was really close to the university, but it was more of a gated community. So we got kind of pampered there. But what we tried to do, and again, Karen and I have both traveled a lot. Karen was in the Peace Corps in 84 and 85 in Kenya, East Africa. And so we love to embrace the local culture. So we ate out all the time. We ate in some pretty interesting places, and we ate a lot of different food, and it was great. A lot less variety types of food than what you'd see in China. So again, pretty staple food products, maybe prepared differently, but nothing too exotic when it came to meat or those kinds of things. Yeah. But it was, you know, probably our hardest thing eating over there is we had to sit on these little blue plastic benches that were about a foot and a half off the ground. And, and at 58, I don't bend like I used to.
Because you haven't been bending your whole life like many of them have. Yeah.
Exactly.
How is pork then part of that diet?
Actually, pork is their number one meat that they have in Vietnam. But again, much like China, there's no such thing as a pork chop or a pork loin or a big chunk of ham. You'll see a lot more smaller pieces of meat, be it in a soup, a stew, or a stir fry. And so again, they eat smaller amounts of meat per day, a lot more vegetables, a lot of fruits. And I tell you what, the fresh fruits were probably one of our most favorite things about being in Vietnam. I mean, in January, we had some incredible watermelons, and we hit them throughout the whole year. So it was great.
Mm-hmm. Talk about what happens next. How do you look ahead and sort of maintain connections? What's next for the work that you've done here, and what's next for you?
A couple of things that we're going to try to do. First of all, we're working with the South Dakota Soybean Research and Promotion Council. They provided us a grant to help bring some of the grad students from Vietnam over to SDSU for the summertime to help show them, you know, the type of research that we have, expose them to our swine industry, help get them better prepared. So build those relationships there. Another really great tool that we're trying to maintain that connection with, Ms. Thu Hong, a Vietnamese national, is in charge of the Fulbright program. And on the side, she started a program called Bookworm. And I would like to encourage all your listeners to think about it and contact me if they're interested. But, you know, the young people in Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City and Da Nang, large cities, they're doing well. But a lot of the country's rural and education's tough. There's not a lot of resources. So Thu Hong started a project called Bookworm. And that's where we get used books from the U.S. or anywhere else, and probably, you know, children's book from, you know, three years of age, maybe up till sixth grade, picture books, those kinds of things. And then she has a nonprofit where she sends them out to the country to help kids in the rural areas learn to read and speak English a lot better. So that's something that's pretty exciting.
How will you maintain the friendships that you made? And do you think that there are things that you brought home, you know, even though you were largely there to sort of help, you know, show a path that you know, they haven't seen yet. But did you learn anything that could be brought back to South Dakota that would be beneficial to the ag industry or to just the way we live?
Yeah, I think, you know, and anybody who's traveled internationally will say this. I mean, we get changed more than a change difference we make there. I mean, any time you travel internationally, you really look at things a lot differently. And again, the people were so gracious in Vietnam and warm, you know, and they do a better job of keeping family in perspective than I think we do here, too. You know, we work pretty hard, and maybe we don't focus on family as much as we should. So that's one of the things that we learned. They do a lot more social things together than we probably typically do here, too. So those are some things we think about doing. Certainly with the internet, it makes the connection so much easier. We would love to go back. We plan on going back someday. Actually, when we got this blast of cold weather, Karen thought it would be pretty good to head back to Hanoi right now, but that's not going to happen. But again, yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways to help and interact and keep those relationships, and that's what we want to do.